At the top of our program, studying the final frontier of space got a little easier this month. On May 5th, a group of scientists launched an online simulator that allows users to explore our galaxy in incredibly accurate detail. It covers a span of billions of years. But what's the most innovative part of this new project? Anyone can use it, whether you're getting your doctorate in astrophysics or you're just a curious web surfer. This project and many others are part of a movement to make scientific research and data open to use and scrutiny by scientists as well as the general public. It's a movement called Open Science, and it attempts to remove the traditionally restrictive ways in which scientific research is both conducted and shared. With us today to speak more about open science and its potential for scientific research, Dr. Ian Dworkin from MSU's Department of Zoology. An associate professor at MSU, Ian participated in a panel last fall about open science and has shared his views regarding the movement openly in his blog. Welcome, Ian. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. Well, thank you for having me on Current State.
Tell us a little bit more how you would describe the open science movement to a non-scientist. You run into somebody at the party and you say, what is open science? How do you describe it?
It's a great question. So fundamentally, open science is exactly as you describe it. We're trying to make all aspects of what we do open to everybody, whether that is the sort of final summary that we do when we publish papers, so we, you know, summarize things in our manuscripts, or it's the actual data that we generate, the raw data and other forms of the data, and how we actually analyze that data. All of these things have gotten increasingly complex, but at the same time, we now have, through the internet, an ability to store and disseminate that very easily. And so the idea is to make everything we do very easy for other scientists and for members of the public to access, to make comments on it, to ask questions, and to just free it up to basically achieve the goals of science that have been set for the last 400 years of making this an open endeavor for all of society.
And what's the potential impact of this movement?
I think there's a couple of really important potentials. One, for scientists, is to make scientific research happen faster. And the reason that might happen is because with science, in traditional, the traditional methods that science has worked by, both the publication of our work, but also the data, to get it from one person to another. It used to be you'd either have to mail it or you'd go and have to visit another lab somewhere else, potentially in the world. It could be on the other side of the world to access it. Now with this, if somebody has some questions that they want to address, and maybe you've done some experimental work that may help them address that, if that data is already available, they may be able to move forward very quickly. So from the point of view of scientists, it may make our progress faster and potentially more efficient.
Continue, please.
For the more general public, I think it's will help, in particular now where I think there's still concerns about between the public and the scientists about sort of communication. How well do we communicate with the public about what we do, how we get there? Often our work is funded by the public through agencies like the National Science Foundation or National Institutes of Health. People honestly want to know what we're doing with this money that they're supporting us with. And this provides a way of saying, hey, this is what we do. This is how we do it. And if you want to know more, you can be a lay member of the public, mm-hmm. but still, if you're interested, find out and work with that data.
So it's more connectivity.
Absolutely.
Due to the internet. How have you been involved, Ian?
So I got involved in a couple of ways. So when I did my own research for my PhD many years ago, I was in a very small lab. And so we actually had to rely on many other researchers to help us with resources. And so from fairly early on, I was in a culture of we would support other people whenever we produced something that could help them, and they would help us. More generally, when I moved here to East Lansing and to Michigan State University, my work has become very computational. And so I spent a lot of time not only people in my lab generating lots of data of all sorts and often very large data sets, but we also have complicated ways that we try to analyze this data. And many other scientists have asked for this data, and so I had to figure out ways that was easy to disseminate this. And because of that, I started saying, okay, what's the most efficient ways to do that and to get this to other people? And so over the last few years, I've been getting very involved with the open science movement to understand, in a practical sense, how best to do it. What are the best practices?
We're talking about the open science movement with Dr. Ian Dworkin. Ian's an MSU associate professor in the Department of Zoology. Are there sectors within the scientific community where open science has gained particular traction?
Yeah, so there's a couple of very important ones. Physics has been a very open discipline for a very long time. This is not my own discipline. And that's often because they have very, very large projects that they're doing. And so there's very large groups of people working on it. And whether it's the way that they publish their manuscripts and make them available, or actual sharing of data itself and analysis, that's always been a fairly open discipline. In biology, and in my particular area, which is in genetics, certain aspects of it have really moved to that. And part of this has been mandated by the institutes in the federal government that fund much of our work, that basically say, we know you're producing lots of data, and it's expensive to generate, so we want to make sure everybody gets the biggest bang for the buck. And so set up public repositories for these data, basic places. Once we generate it, here's where the data goes. These are the ways you should reproduce it so there's sort of a generic format so anybody who wants to use it can go and look at it and know what everything means and use that. And so
it doesn't sound like it's of a whole lot of value to the lay public. It's really, at least with that example, it sounds as if it has more relevance to your fellow scientists.
That's absolutely correct. Where it becomes much more interesting to the public is at two levels. One, obviously, there are many areas where the public and scientists interface, whether it's issues of climate change or issues of evolutionary biology, where perhaps there are still controversies. And in those particular areas, this provides a great venue to say, you know, if somebody's skeptical of the scientific endeavors that we do, this provides a venue of saying, well, this is the actual data, and you can see what we've done, and here's how we've analyzed it. And so that's a one level. And of course, that still might require some level of expertise. But the other level at which open science really interacts with the public is something called citizen science, which is the idea of integrating the public into scientific projects. And this is often done with people who study bird and bird, species of birds, and whether they're disappearing, conservation. So people look at those sorts of they integrate public people who may be enjoying going birding for their own purposes, but then they help them collect data. And that data itself is public so that the public can sort of say, hey, not only did I help generate it, but I can go look at it and maybe even use it to figure out where, if I want to see species, you know, a particular bird, where to go find it or something like that.
Is there resistance to the open science movement?
There is a little bit of resistance. I would say that the vast majority of scientists are completely open to the idea. Where the concerns come in, there's a few. One is, scientists in recent years have undergone additional levels of sort of bureaucracy. We have a lot more forms to fill out and things like that. And so for some people, this feels like just one more thing that they have to do to get on with their science. And so they feel like it distracts from them from their actual science. I think as we've become more efficient at figuring out ways of disseminating our data and making a sort of a more clear path forward, that's becoming less of an issue. Probably the most substantial issue that is repeated among scientists, the broadest concern is, well, what if somebody misuses that data? So climate change scientists may be concerned if that data gets misused by climate change deniers about something like that. However, in some sense, having that as an open discussion is possibly useful as well, although those concerns are quite real.
In your blog, you say that you're not sure if you're willing to be a martyr with regard to your full participation in open science. What do you mean by that?
That's a great question. So that directly has to do with a certain aspect of the open science movement, which is about open access publishing. So until quite recently, most of the journals that we published in were subscription-based. So that means that private companies publish our papers and end up getting the copyrights for those papers, even though we've done the scientific research and the public has paid usually for that scientific research. Most of the very prestigious journals in sciences are of this nature. But there's been a big movement to make what's called open access journals where anybody can read it. So they are open to everybody, and the funding mechanism for them isn't based on library subscriptions. So only the the most wealthy universities and members of those universities can see it, but anybody can see these. And some of these journals have not, the open access journals, some of them have become quite prestigious themselves, but many are still in the scientific community. Scientists can be a little, because of the skeptical nature, can be conservative about some aspects of change, and particularly about scholarly communication. And so it's been slow to be accepted in some areas. And so, including my area, some open access journals are widely regarded, but other ones are not.
So how much impact could open science have on the status quo in higher education? Are you suggesting that could be pretty dramatic?
I think it can be. That's in a couple of very interesting ways. One, obviously, there's many universities. Michigan State here in East Lansing is quite a well-off, large university, and we have many resources. But there's many universities, not just in the United States, but across the world, which don't have the kinds of resources. And this opens up for those teachers, for the professors at these different institutions, or for high school teachers, for that matter, access to these journals. One of the other really important areas is for medical research. So patients who have often, particularly for rare diseases where there's not a lot of information to go on, there's rarely summaries that their doctors can provide for them about their diseases, and they do have to interact with that literature, the scientific literature. And having this for free instead of having to pay $20 or $30 for every scientific article to understand something about their condition may be helpful. And that's an important area, I think, and is already quite widely used.
One thing that jumps out at me is how territorial some people will always be about their research. I would think there's some percentage of scientists who take, who have worked very hard at learning what they've learned, who might, for that very reason, be less willing to share it with the public.
Absolutely, Mark. So there is still a group of scientists, for sure, and they're fairly active if you read scientific blogs, who say, well, it's taken me a really long time to collect this data, and it's not to use this data or to use how I've developed the way I do my analysis. I want to keep doing it, and I want to make sure I have first dibs, basically, at producing new scientific research from that, and so are concerned about that. And I think there's some legitimate concern for some people about that, especially at smaller institutions, at smaller schools. But in general, once you are publishing your data with respect to one question, you're answering one question and publishing one paper, then that data should be made available. In fact, that idea has been out there for a very long time, and most journals require it. The other thing that might happen, and which is, most scientists don't want to say this publicly, but of course it's always a concern, is we're people, we make mistakes. Scientists, we recognize that we make mistakes. And as both the experiments that we do and the analyses that we do get more complicated, the possibility of making mistakes becomes more likely, right? And we try to be conscientious and check for them, but always people are worried about, well, what if somebody finds a mistake?
Exactly, yeah. Ian Dworkin is an MSU associate professor in the Department of Zoology. We have been talking about the open science movement. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Mark.